The topic for today is Levi of yesteryear, Levi of tomorrow. And the starting point for this, as I mentioned yesterday, that there are a couple of places in the Torah where reference is made to the three nations that were promised to Abraham and that were not given to the Jews when they left Egypt, but which were held in abeyance until the ultimate redemption when the Jews are going to inherit the territory of those three nations as well. And one of the places in the Torah where that seems to appear, at least according to some Mefarshim, is in the Sifrei, which is the Medrash Halacha, on Sefer Devarim. And that's source number 12. It says, V'nachala, the full pasuk is, V'nachala lo yihyeh lo bekerev echav, that the Kohanim and the Levim will not have a nachala, they will not have an inheritance in the midst of their brothers, and Hashem hu nachala so, God is their inheritance. That's the pasuk. The Medrash Halacha interprets the pasuk as follows. Nachala, zo nachalas shlosha. The nachala of three. Lo yihye lo bekerev echav, zo nachalas chamisha. This is the inheritance, the nachala of five. What does three mean? And what does five mean? So just to start off, yesterday, in my last-minute preparations of going through everything, I found that the Vilna Gaon changes the girsa of this braisa to a girsa which is not even on the list of five girsas that I have in the next chart. Right? The Vilna Gaon changes this to say nachala zo nachlas shlosha, that the Levim will not have an inheritance from the three, and bekerev echav, this refers to nachlas shiva, the seven. And clearly, what the Vilna Gaon is referring to, the Nachala of three, is the Nachala of the three remaining nations, the Keni, the Kenizi, the Kadmoni, the three that the Jews did not get at Yetzias Mitzrayim, that the Levim are not going to have a share in the Nachala of those three nations. And Nachlas Shiva is a reference to the seven nations which the Jews inherited their territory when they left Mitzrayim. And that's the Vilna Gaon's Girsa, that this Medrash is telling us that they're not going to have a share in the Nachla of three, and they're not going to have a share in the Nachla of seven. The Levim are supposed to be landless because they're consecrated to the Avodas Beis HaMikdash. Presumably, being a farmers and being shackled or bound to the soil would have interfered with their ability to perform their function as Kohanim, as Ovdei Avoda, as Morei Hora, as whatever it was that they were supposed to perform in Klal Yisrael. The question is, the Girsa that we have in front of us is not 3 and 7, it's 3 and 5. So if we assume that 3 means those remaining three nations that the Jews did not conquer it by the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, why is it that the second number is 5 and not 7? The Vilna Gaon's Girsa seems to be a lot more accurate. 3 and 7. It's the three future nations and the seven nations of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why 3 and 5? So the Netziv has an interesting suggestion. He says, look at what parsha this Medrash Halacha appears in. It's in Parshas Shoftim, which is in Sefer Devarim, which took place after everything that happened in the desert. Sefer Devarim is just Moshe Rabbeinu's last speech that he gave to Klal Yisrael. So this pasuk was taught to the Jews after they conquered the land of Sichon, and after they conquered the land of Og. Sichon and Og were two of the Canaanite nations. Sichon was a Melech HaEmori, and Og was a Melech HaBashan. Bashan also was supposed to correspond to one of the Canaanite nations. And so the fact that the Levim would not get a portion in two of the nations was already in the past. It was not in the future. And so says the Netziv, the Medrash says, of the remaining eight nations that the Jews are going to inherit, the Levim are not going to have a portion in the three that they'll inherit, La'asid Lavo, nor will they have a portion in the five that they'll inherit immediately thereafter in the times of Yehoshua.
But
so,
in actuality, they wouldn't have a portion in anything. Levim.
Anything?
They had a responsibility, but they weren't going to have enough.
They got 48
What?
They got 28 cities. I mean, that's the parsha of this week.
Oh.
But the cities weren't.
You know, they didn't live in there. They live on the.
But the cities weren't theirs. They were. You know, they had a permanent lease, a lifetime lease on the cities, but it wasn't there.
Yeah, of course. But they had to live somewhere. So.
Yeah.
You're right. But you know what?
So how did they pay for houses?
from the maestros, from Trumos and maestros.
You don't pay a hassan bill with a piece of bread, with a piece of corn.
You have to get enough of it, but
they never earned any money.
Not necessarily. They could have earned money also. Just they weren't farmers. They weren't farmers.
Made in the field. Let me show you.
Could be.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
I know, but it works like hell. They don't think any hassle
money.
Let's see. We'll go on. Yeah, the Levium were not barred necessarily from professions, those of them who needed to pursue them in order to earn a livelihood. However, they didn't have land, and so they weren't able, practically speaking, to be farmers, and if they were to find a profession, it would have to be some other profession.
How about after 50, when they don't work anymore? After 50, would they be allowed to have land? They're not working.
If they want to buy land from someone and then return it in Yovel time, so they can buy land and return it in Yovel.
But they can own land after 50?
No, they can own land whenever, just that they don't have ancestral land. They don't have land which is a legacy passed down in their families. They definitely know. There's no prohibition for them to purchase land, just for them to inherit land, for them to have an ancestral land. Yeah, very likely.
Kohanim, if the land was not redeemed, it went to the Kohanim.
It went to the Rebbe, not necessarily to the Levium, though.
No, the Kohanim. Yeah.
Now you know.
Yeah. Now that's a point that we'll have to keep in mind for later on. Because keep it in mind, and then when the appropriate time comes, mention it again. So this is what we have, the Medrash that says that they're not going to get the Nachla of 3, they're not going to get the Nachla of 7, or they're not going to get the Nachla of the 3 future nations, and they're not going to get the Nachla of the 5 immediate nations. However, there are 3 other Girsaos, 3 other versions of this Medrash, that the Rishonim had a different version of this Medrash. Somehow there's a lot of confusion that surrounded the transcribing of this Medrash as it was passed down from the times of the Tanoim to our times, and you can easily imagine how the numbers may have gotten a little bit smudged, and so one Rishon would have seen it one way and another Rishon would have seen it another way, or some other form of confusion. And so therefore we have the following, 4 different Girsaos, excluding the Girsa of the Gra. As you can see, right, the source number 13 will tell us that it's 5 and 7, not 3 and 7, not 3 and 5, but 5 and 7. Source number 15 will tell us that it's Sha'ar, the remainder, and 7. Source number 15 will tell us 5 and 7 again, but with a different interpretation. Source number 16 will tell us again, remainder and 5. So let's just get a little bit of a sense of what is the meaning and what are the implications, what are the broader ramifications of these different versions of the text of the Sifrei. So the Ramban in source number 13 tells us the following. Now keep in mind, the Ramban Girsa is 5 and 7. What does 5 and 7 mean? Says the Ramban, this is consistent with the Ramban that we saw yesterday. The 5 nations are those mentioned in the verse, quote, Ki yivyacha Hashem Elokecha el Eretz HaKenani, HaChiti, HaEmori, HaChivi, VeHaYivusi. 5 nations, Asher Nishba Lavosecha Lases Lach, Eretz, Zavas, Chalav, Udvash. They are the main inheritance of the Jews, since their land is flowing with milk and honey. That's the Nachalat Chamisha, the inheritance of 5. The remaining 2 are the Perizi and the Girgashi, whose land is not flowing with milk and honey, and hence not obligated in Bikurim. Hashem mentioned that the Levim will not receive a portion in the main inheritance, namely the land of 5, and not even in the land of 7, meaning in the remaining 2, even though their land was not so good and not so desirable in the eyes of the other Jews, and therefore you may have thought that since it was less desirable, it would be less of a problem for the Levim to take, at least from those 2 lands. This is the Ramban's Girsa and the Ramban's interpretation of this Girsa. Now, in source number 14, we have from the Avi Ezvi, Rabbi Shach, Rabbi Lazar Menachem Manshach was the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich. He wrote a tremendous sefer on the Rambam. It was published, I think, in 4 different editions. And then, towards the end of his lifetime, they collated all of the different editions. And now there's a single, I'll tell you, it's Madura Kama, Madura Tinyana, Talisa, Rivya, and it's all in one volume. And over here, so you can find this at the end of Hilchos Shmita V'Yovel, and Rav Shach makes the following observation. He says, we can bring proof to the Rambam from this Sifrei. We'll get to this Rambam that he's trying to bring proof for in a second. The Rambam explains that we include, the Ramban explains, meaning the Ramban that we just saw, that we include even the lands of Parizi and the Girgashi, even though they're not flowing with milk and honey. You would have thought, again, that the Levium should take from those lands, because they're not as fertile and as verdant as the other 5 nations' territories. And yet the Pasuk says, no, the Levium are not going to take from the lands. Without the Pasuk, the Levium would have taken a portion in those lands. And it's only because there's a Gzeres HaKasov, there's a scriptural decree, that the Levium don't get in those 2 countries. Clearly, says Rav Shach, we need a Gzeres HaKasov to include these 2 lands. And presumably, in other lands that were not included by a scriptural decree, such as if the Jews were to conquer other countries after they conquered the territory of these ten nations, if they were to conquer other countries and consecrate those countries with the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, there would be no impediment to the Levium taking a portion in those other countries. Because even these 2 countries, logic dictates that the Levium should have gotten a portion there, because they're not quite Zavas Chalavud Vash. There's a special Gzeres HaKasov that says no, but in other countries, logic dictates that because they're not as bountiful, that the Levium should get a portion, and there is no Gzeres HaKasov that tells us to go against what logic dictates, and so, because those lands are not so bountiful, if the lands are not so bountiful, the Levium will be able to take an inheritance. In other lands that were not included by scriptural decree, how do we know that Kohanim and Levim should not take a portion?
The Levim fight the war. They didn't fight, right?
No.
Because normally the ones that fight are the ones that inherit. That's the way it usually, supposed to be that way. That's what happened with the Bnei, they settled the Yivra Yarnay, what's that called? That was the whole problem, because they said, you're going to sit here and do nothing, and you got to fight.
Isn't there a story by David HaMelech that David HaMelech, his camp was raided by the Amalekim, and so he split up his army in 2. He said he had one group of people defend what's left, and he had the second half of the army chase after the Amalekim, and they managed to catch up, and they got rid of the Amalekim, and they took a lot of booty. And David HaMelech came back, and the soldiers who had been in pursuit wanted to take all of the spoils, and David HaMelech said no. Kachile kayotzi batzava kena yoshiv al akilim, something along those lines. Then we split it equally between the soldiers who were combat soldiers, the soldiers who were support soldiers, should split it equally.
But if you're not soldier, you're simply not soldier.
They're still called soldiers.
A lazy, you're not a soldier.
No. Ooh, the Rambam says they're tzva Hashem, tzvos Hashem.
Paying taxes, whatever.
Yeah, I don't. You're drawing me into a politically volatile discussion. So I think that I want to stop it for now, and we can continue afterwards. I don't want to say anything. Yeah. So.
Two areas that were not milk and honey. The tribes, finally, the tribes settled over there.
So yeah, tribes, for sure.
That
I'm not sure. You have to check this atlas here. The Ramban says it's the Parizi and the Girgashi. Right, so let's just see. This is brought me. What's your name? Reb Tzvi brought me this atlas of biblical lands, and so we can just check in the atlas and see where the kingdoms of the Parizi and the Girgashi were.
You won't see it any further, because then it's not mentioned anymore. You see here, Hittites.
We need the Parizi and the Girgashi. So, here's Yavusi, Hitti, Amaleki, Keni. Kanani, Amori.
No,
I don't see any
in different colors,
Rashi.
So you can find it. I'm sure there is somewhere here, but
is that your sacred name?
No, it is, but I have something very similar, and I forgot to bring it.
No, it's
here. I don't see any Prezi's or Girgashi's here. I don't know. It's not going to be this late.
No,
but
later on
we
will not see it anymore. Like,
so these tribes settled in this area, the Nadmulukanani, and the 12 tribes with the promised land of Mulukanani, they got the short end of things.
Passively.
They were merchants, and you know, Zvulun was the...
Well, the Gemara has a discussion also that says that that there was an assessment of the value of land. So the tribes that got in the more bountiful places got less land per person, and the tribes that got in the more bountiful places, in the less bountiful places, got more per person. It was based on value rather than based simply on square footage.
In principle, we were supposed to get land and milk and honey, and they were not getting, but some people not getting.
Yeah. It's also possible that the borders were carved in such a way that everyone had an equal amount of each of these territories.
Well, they got free milk and honey.
Right, with the free federal school lunch program.
Who edited that safer? Who was the editor of that safer? You know?
Hammond and Company from Maplewood, New Jersey.
Famous Atlas people.
Atlas people. Not according to Rashi or the Ramban.
Is that Charles? So Rav Shach wanted to prove from the Ramban's version of the Medrash, he wanted to prove that if Klal Yisrael were to conquer some other country after they conquered the territory of these 10 Kanani nations, that the Kohanim and the Levim would have a share, they would have a Nachla in this other country. It would be split up amongst the Kohanim and the Levim, as well as amongst the other of the other 11 or 12 tribes. Now, you could say that it's not really such a proof, that the Pasuk, which says that they don't get from the territory of the Prizi and the Girgashi, it meant that just like they don't get a territory in the land which is flowing with milk and honey, they also don't have an inheritance in the land which is not flowing with milk and honey. It's not referring to Prizi and Girgashi as two specific territories. It could be that it's referring to Prizi and Girgashi as examples of territories that are not flowing with milk and honey, and it's telling you that even in such territories, the Kohanim and the Levim don't get an inheritance. But at least we've already seen that the text of this Medrash, the proper text of this Medrash, is critical for determining Le'osid Lavo, right? Hence, that's the Levi of tomorrow in the title, and that's the future Israel, right, in the title of the whole series, that there's a big question about which territories Levim and Kohanim will get land in, which territories Levim and Kohanim will not get land in, and this Medrash seems to be at the center of the debate. So let's see some of the other readings of this Medrash. Rashi brings down two other interpretations. He says, and by the way, the translations of Tanakh come from Machon Mamre online. The translations of Rambam, for the most part, are from the Chabad website, as are the translations of Rashi. Translations of Gemara, for the most part, are from the online Sansino Talmud, and all other translations are my own. Okay.
Sansino is what's the first one?
They're the only ones that have online. Cut and paste.
I'm talking about from years ago.
You will not get out call on that.
Well, if you go through the book that they published recently, there was a history.
That wasn't a figure of imagination at that time.
They published a book recently, The History of the Printing of the Talmud,
which
I think finds even earlier translations into English than Sansino. Yeah. But you have to
English?
Check.
Yeah, I think that was by a non-Jew.
Probably knew. The printing was
it's very interesting, the printing of the Talmud.
So Rashi here in source number 15 says as follows. I'm going to read it in the Hebrew. I'll give my own translation as I'm going. Those of you who want, you can follow along in English and tell me whether I'm saying the same thing as this English translation or not. V'sifrei darshu. In Sifrei, we have the following drasha. V'nachla lo yihye lo, zo nachlat sha'ar. This is the nachla of the remainder. Bekerev echav, when it says bekerev echav, in the midst of his brothers, zo nachlat shiva, this is a reference to the nachla of seven. But any yadei mahu, I don't know what the nachla of the remainder, the nachla of seven are. V'nir Ali, says Rashi, it appears to me, she'eretz kanan, she'mei eiver hayardein, eretz kanan, on the other side of the Jordan, nikreis eretz chamisha amamin, it's called the land of the five nations. The Emori, like Sichon Melech HaEmori, was in Transjordan. The other five nations were in Eretz Yisrael proper. V'shal Sichon v'Og, shnei amamin, Emori u'Kanani, Sichon and Og were the Emori and the Kanani, and they were on the other side of the Jordan. V'nachlat Sha'ar, so when we say Nachlat Shiva, we mean the five in Eretz Yisrael proper, the two Me'ever Hayardin, and Nachlat Sha'ar, says Rashi, the Rabot, Keni, Ukenizi, the Kadmoni, to include the three nations that the Jews did not inherit when they left Egypt. So in other words, Rashi seems to be very consistent with the Vilna Gaon, except for where the Vilna Gaon has three and seven, Rashi has remainder and seven. But fundamentally, he's saying the same interpretation of the Medrash as the Vilna Gaon. Then he says, Shuv nimtza b'divrei Rabbi Klonimuth. Afterwards, I found that Rabbi Klonimuth wrote that Hachi Garsiran b'Sifrei, the correct text of this Sifrei is the following. V'nachla lo yihye lo, elu nachlat chamisha. It's referring to the nachla of five. B'kerev echav, elu nachlat shiva. It's a nachla of seven. This was the version that the Ramban had of the Sifrei, but as we'll see, Rabbi Klonimus had a slightly different interpretation of the significance of five and seven. Nachlat Chamisha, says Rashi, is the Chamisha Shvatim, the five tribes, and Nachlat Shiva is the seven tribes. It's not a reference to nations of Canaan, but rather it's a reference to the nations, to the tribes of Israel, for a total of 12 tribes. 5 and 7 make a total of 12. Mitoch Shemosha Yoshua lo chalku nachla ela lechamisha shvatim bilvad. Moshe and Yoshua only split up Eretz Yisrael. They were only zoche to give out portions of Eretz Yisrael to five of the Shvatim. Shekin Moshe hinchil l'Ruvain v'Gad v'lachatzi Sheva Menashe. Moshe gave out to two and a half tribes. And Yoshua hinchil Yehuda v'Ephraim v'lachatzi Sheva Menashe. Yoshua gave out to another two and a half tribes. So that's what it means that the Kohanim are not going to get any Nachala from the lands that Moshe and Yoshua gave out. And then the Shiva, Acherim, not Lume Eilean, they took on their own Acherim Mos Yoshua. That's why they're mentioned separately. Now, the question that we have to consider, according to Rabbi Klonimus, is why would there be a Hava Amina that the Kohanim should have more of a share in the Nachla of 7 than they would in the Nachla of 5? We understand, according to the Ramban, that you would think that the land of milk and honey should be reserved for the ones who don't have special privileges vis-a-vis the avoda, right? And the land, and so you need a pasuk to tell me that even lands which are not flowing with milk and honey, the Kohanim are still excluded from those lands. But according to Rabbi Klonimus, why would I have thought that the Kohanim should only be excluded from the lands that Moshe and Yoshua gave out, and that they should not be excluded from the other lands? And I think that the last line of Rashi may indicate that he feels that that's not really the point of the Medrash. The point really is that they're not going to get a chilek at all. It's still a little bit difficult. We have to figure out why should it be that there's a greater assumption, a greater hava amina, that logic would tell you more that...
Because they took by themselves. So there was a different distribution after Yoshua. And maybe at that time they say, okay, it's open season, maybe they'll include us as well.
Meaning not that there's a real Hava Amina, just that the Kohanim might have a bigger Yetzer Hara to take on their own because it's all a free-for-all, and so we need to tell them...
It looks like, you know, now they divided among themselves. They say, okay, so before there was a restriction, maybe now there is no restriction.
She's really got a point.
be like to find out if it's
looking into it.
Exactly.
Very good. Okay. Find reference to this. I mean, this is just an assumption.
Well, I'll tell you what the reference is. We'd have to jump ahead a little bit. So keep your suggestion in mind also. We have now on the table number one, right? Remind me, what are you remembering for us for later on in this year? Okay, at least it is
about the Kohanim getting, when there was a Nachla Chuza that was not redeemed, it went to the Kohanim.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let me write that down also, so I don't forget it.
Don't tell me you don't remember. You did remember.
I was trying to be humorous.
You did remember.
We have thin eye to be
fake. Excellent. So we have now. There's a Vilna Gaon. There's a Netziv. There's the Ramban. There's Rashi. There's Rabbeinu Klonimus. Let's just round that out with one final interpretation of this medrash, and that is it's really the first one to have this interpretation was either Rabbeinu Tam or else the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol. Both were very early Baalei HaTosfos, and here I happen to quote it from the commentary of the Baalei HaTosfos on the Torah, and they write as follows. The Sefrei writes, inheritance, this refers to the inheritance of the remainder, the Sha'ar. And the Bichor Sha'ar, one of the Baalei Tosfos explains, that this refers to the inheritance of Don, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Binyamin, Ephraim, and Menashe. In the midst of his brothers, this refers to the inheritance of five, namely Reuven, Shimon, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zebulun, who were Levi's maternal brothers. And even so, he will not inherit together with them. In other words, you may have thought that the ones who were not maternal brothers with Levi, so Levi's not going to encroach upon their inheritance. They get a full inheritance. But perhaps Levi's maternal brothers should each get a smaller inheritance, and they should share one-fifth, right, of their inheritance with Levi. Says the Pasuk, no, Levi's not even going to inherit a portion together with his maternal brothers.
Nobody's going to be left out completely?
So he's going to be left out completely. Yeah. So let's just put things together for a second, because I want to now focus a little bit on the ramifications, right, of these versions of the Medrash. We saw that there's a discussion about the lands that are flowing with milk and honey, the five lands. We saw that there's a reference to the seven, which the Jews are going to inherit immediately upon leaving Mitzrayim. We saw that there's a reference to ten, right, to the remaining three, the Nachlat Sha'ar in Rashi's terms, or the Nachlat Shlosha in the terms of the Vilna Gaon, the three lands that we're going to inherit in the times of Mashiach. And then Rav Shach took the discussion to what happens after the Jews finish consecrating all of Eretz Yisrael. What about other lands that the Jews invest with Kedusha? Are the Kohanim going to be excluded from inheriting those lands as well? And so there are four different strata here. There's the Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. There's the Eretz Shiva Amamin that the Jews inherited when they left Egypt. There's the Eretz Asara Amamin, the remaining three countries. And then there are other lands which are outside of the lands of the ten nations that were promised to Abraham.
What is it? Can inherit before capturing additional land or after. I mean, if he's entitled to land, he should be entitled to land no matter what. So why is it only if you conquer additional land can they potentially have the opportunity to use it?
That's a good question. The simplest answer, I think, is that because Eretz Yisrael has a higher level of Kedusha, so there may be something unique about Trumos and Maisos in Eretz Yisrael, that those are supposed to go to the Kohanim. It could be that in other countries, even though once they're invested with Kedusha, they'll have Kedusha and one will need to take off Trumas and Maestros, but the Trumas and Maestros from those countries are not so special that they need to go to the Kohanim. The Kohanim are not getting the Trumos and Maestros from those countries, so then they ought to be entitled to a portion in the land. In Eretz Yisrael, so instead of getting a portion of the land, they're entitled to take the Trumos and the Maestros, which end up being 10, 20, whatever the exact number is, percentage, right, of the crop. In the other countries where perhaps they're not going to be entitled to Trumos and Maestros, so since they're not, you know, they're not getting those, then they need to have a portion of the land.
So you're saying that originally they didn't get land because it was a substitute for land? The gifts that they got from Lord Nasa was a substitute for getting land?
Passively, yes. Right? Or we can say that that, you know, the land of Eretz Yisrael proper was given to the other Shvatim because, you know, the Kohanim had, you know, the Kohanim had other things, other privileges that they got, and though this was such a bountiful land that the Shvatim were not willing to give up even a single square foot of it. But to the other places where the land is a little bit less bountiful, that's why there's a Havamina even in the two places which are not Zavat Chalav Udvash, so because the Shvatim won't care about it so much, so therefore perhaps there's less concern of giving it to the Kohanim.
I think it was the decision of the Mesa whether to give the Kohanim land or not, if that was originally planned that way.
It was originally.
So it wasn't their decision, or wasn't their input shouldn't have made a difference.
The
Moshe Rabbeinu comes out and says, you know, you're going to get land, you're not going to get land. It has nothing to do with it, what desire the Messiah is.
Part of the question is, like, why is it that Kohanim don't get land? So it may have something to do with the fact that there is a chavivus for Eretz Yisrael proper, and that it would be wrong for the Shvatim to just say, okay, you know, the Kohanim can, you know, can take some of my land in Eretz Yisrael proper. And since the Kohanim are entitled to other things, Hashem hu nachalaso, they're doing the avodas hamikdash, they get trumos and maestros, so it just wouldn't be right for the Shvatim to say, okay, let the Kohanim have, you know, we're happy to share and share alike. But when you're talking about land which is outside of the Eretz Yisrael, the Havamina is even land which is not chadzavat chalav udvash, so then it wouldn't be so so much of an insult to Eretz Yisrael for the Shvatim to say, you know what, I don't care, let the Kohanim have some of it also, and so we would allow that to happen. I think we'll develop this a little bit more in a moment or two as we get to the machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid in sources 17 and 18. So let's take a look here. The Rambam and the Ravid appear at the end of Hilchos Shmita V'Yovel, right before the famous Rambam that talks about the Kohanim being God's army as well. And the Rambam here writes the following: the entire tribe of Levi are commanded against receiving an inheritance in the land of Canaan, and they were commanded against receiving a share in the spoils when the cities are conquered. As the Torah states in Parsha in Sefer Devarim, the priest and the Levi, the entire tribe of Levi, they should not have a portion and an inheritance among Israel. A portion refers to the portion of the spoil, and an inheritance refers to a portion of the land. It also says, you shall not receive a heritage in their land. Right, sorry, it says, the pasuk is, Be'artzam lo tinchal, you will not inherit in their land. Ve'chilek lo yihye lecha bitocham, that you won't have a chilek, a portion, in their midst. This refers to the spoil. The chilek, the portion, in their midst refers to the spoil. If a Levi or a priest takes a portion of the spoil, he's punished by Malchus. If he takes an inheritance in Eretz Yisrael, it should be taken from his possession and restored to the tribe from which it was taken. It appears to me, says the Rambam, and this is a critical part of the Rambam, it appears to me that the above applies only... Joe, I'll give you the honor of reading it because you're the one who's going to be most startled by it.
Most startled?
Yeah. Go ahead.
It appears to me that the above applies only with regard to land for which a covenant was established, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Their descendants inherited, and it was divided among them. If, however, other lands will be conquered by a king of Israel, the priests and the Levites have the same rights as the entire Jewish people.
I read that also.
So we're under the impression that the Kohanim should never be entitled to any land. But here the Rambam is saying, it appears to me that if something outside of Eretz Yisrael proper was conquered by a king of Israel, that the Kohanim and the Levim would have the same rights to that land, right, as the remainder of the Jewish people.
This is a startling view by the Rambam.
Absolutely.
Are the Kohanim removed to the Torah?
How about that? Syria. Isn't it that the Kohanim doesn't get chelik in Verachala, Eretz Yisrael, because first of all they didn't do anything in Shibud Mitzrayim. They were sitting down and learning, right? They did not interfere into the Shibud. It basically was free, free whatever, free nation. They got anything they got. Now, when they came to Eretz Yisrael, they cannot, basically, it's like you can reward them about whatever they had over there. The other thing is, because the Kadosh Baruch Hu commanded Bnei Yisrael to show that, you know, it's very big good things to support basically Talmidei Chachamim. So that's why they don't have no nachala, and everybody have to basically give them the Tumot and Masod to show that to support is basically rule number one by HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
So let them get land and let them all get Tumot and Masros.
So where is the... No, but isn't it that they say, I think I read in the district parish or something like this, that they get like 2,000 amah from the end of the things.
Yes.
No. So this is, they get. It's not they don't get.
Yeah. How much is 2,000 amos? See, from here to 147th Street, is that 2,000 amos? It's not a lot of. It's not a lot of land at all.
But it's around the camp.
It's supposed to be like they're supposed to have a park around the city, so they get a nice park, but it's not land for farming. They're not even allowed to farm that land.
They are not such a big tribe anyway, compared to other tribes. They're not big.
And you're talking about over the whole scope of history. You know, it could be that yesterday there were a smaller tribe, and tomorrow there'll be a bigger tribe. It really all depends on the birth rate and the demographics. Like that's why, according to one opinion, Eretz Yisrael was split up equally, even though some tribes were bigger at the time that they arrived in Eretz Yisrael, right, and other tribes were smaller. But you can't just split up Eretz Yisrael based on the size of the tribes at the time that the Jews entered. You have to take into account that even tribes that are big right now might be smaller in the next generation. Tribes that are small now might be bigger in the next generation.
But Eretz Yisrael is like Tzvi, you know. Eretz Yisrael is Tzvi, like whatever it is. They're not going to go with them.
Yeah. No, so really, the point that you're making is a very important point. And that is, we need to figure out why the Kohanim, number one, are not entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael, and number two, why are they entitled to Trumos and Maisros and to the other Matnos Kahuna? You're suggesting that the reason they're not entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael is because they didn't experience the Shibud Mitzrayim. Right? Someone else had a different suggestion about why they didn't get a portion in Eretz Yisrael. Incongruous with what?
With what we were talking about.
With the Rambam, right? He's asking a kasha on the Rambam. So once we're asking kashas on the Rambam, let's see the Ravid, right? The Ravid is the Rosh V'Rishon, right? The first one, right? He has priority whenever it comes to asking kashas on the Rambam. And in this case, we don't need to ask the kasha ourselves. The Ravid already asks this question for us. And he disagrees with the Rambam. The Rambam says that Kohanim will have a share in any land that is conquered outside of Eretz Yisrael proper. And the Ravid says, one second, if so, yes, one second. Before we read the Ravid, Alvin, please.
But the feeling was because they get all the tithes and they get the trumas and they get part of the sacrifices in some cases that they don't need land really because they have got all the other stuff.
So they have other things, and maybe that's why it's not because they didn't experience the Shibud in Mitzrayim, but rather it's because God gave them other gifts, and those gifts obviated the need for them to have land in Eretz Yisrael. Right, that's definitely a possibility. And that seems to be very consistent with the Ravid in Source 18. Says the Ravid, if so, if the Kohanim will be entitled to land in areas outside of Eretz Yisrael proper, they should not take Truma and Meiser. Then those lands should be exempt from Truma and Meiser, since these, meaning the Truma and the Meiser, were in exchange for their portion in the land. So if the Kohanim get a portion in lands outside of Eretz Yisrael, then the Yisraelim, who get portions in those lands, should not need to take Truma and Meiser, or should not need to give Truma and Meiser to the Kohanim, because if the Kohanim are having a share, you can have a neighbor who's a Kohen, who's a farmer, then you shouldn't have to give your tithes to that Kohen. So that's question number one that the Ravid mentions. The Ravid, right, is assuming that obviously there will be Trumos and Maestros from other countries that were consecrated with Kedushas Haaretz, and he's also assuming that those Trumos and Maestros will be given to the Kohanim and the Levium, and therefore, he says, if there will be Trumos and Maestros, and the Trumos and Maestros will be given to the Levium, so obviously the Levium should not receive land, because they're instead getting Trumos and Maestros. That's question...
They need the land because it's being supported. They don't need to work the land and get the produce and all that, because they're already getting theirs through other means.
Yeah. So that's question number one of the Ravid. Question number two, says the Ravid, this is Parshas HaShavua, from the spoils of Midian, they didn't take a portion with the rest of the Jews, only a truma, and by command, right, of the Yotzer HaKol Yisbarach, of the Creator, blessed be He. So what exactly does the Ravid mean by this? He's bringing in the spoils of Midian, the Bizat Midian, and he's trying to use this to disprove the Rambam. So how does, the Ravid doesn't spell out for us how the story of the Bizat Midian disproves the Rambam.
That's a truma. That's not truma. Truma is growing things. That golden jewelry.
Well, it was called the Trumat HaBiza, right? The part of
truma
the.
Doesn't mean truma.
It means something that's raised up from the Shoresh Rum. Right? The root of truma is rum. Called Mayram Benisa, something which is elevated, something which is exalted, something which is uplifted.
Korach talks exactly about this. It's written right here in Parsha Korach. His Maser Bnei Israel, Amar the land was floating out of the Nahalah. It's all written in the Pasuk.
Yeah.
So what are we talking about, Ravid and Rambam? It's all written here.
That's talking about the Eretz Yisrael proper. Not necessarily talking about if they were to conquer, you know, Uganda. Right, if they were to conquer Uganda, so would the Kohanim have a share in Uganda or not? That's the question.
No, there's Israel because they don't do the trip. They don't. They have to work also. They have to work and they get the true and all these things because they're working.
Well, they're working in the Beis Hamikdash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll get there also.
They don't get a chelek. It's all written in the Pasuk.
Because they're doing extra work in the Beis Hamikdash, they don't get a chelek in the land.
Well, all this is written here. I don't write this. Here,
what are you trying to say?
Basically, there's a triangle here. We have to consider the following factors. There's the fact that the Kohanim do the Avodah in the Beis Hamikdash. There's the fact that the Kohanim get Trumos and Maestros.
Right.
And there's the fact that the Kohanim don't get the Nachalah.
Right.
So if I jump a little bit ahead of myself, the Mishnah Lamelech asks the question, and he says, which of these two are most closely associated with one another? Is it that the Kohanim don't get a Nachalah because they do the Avodah in the Beis Hamikdash? In which case, it should not make a difference where they are. Somehow, we view the Kohanim having a legacy, an ancestral legacy of land, would be inimical, it would be distracting, it would prevent them from doing the Avodah properly in the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore it is inconsistent to have Kohanim who are doing the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash and who also have ancestral properties. Right, that's one way to look at it, that if they're going to do the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, they can't have land. That's one way to look at it. A second way to look at it is to say that no, it has nothing to do with Avod in the Beis HaMikdash. That's where your point comes in, that obviously the Kohanim get these Sidei HaChirem, the Kohanim get these lands, the fields that became Chirem, they get fields that were consecrated and were not redeemed by Yovel under some circumstances. So we don't have objections per se to Kohanim having land, and even we don't have objections to the Kohanim bequeathing that land to their to their descendants and to their heirs. So we don't have objections per se to that. So why is it then that the Kohanim were not initially entitled to get a share, a portion, an even portion of Eretz Yisrael together with everyone else? It says in the Mishnah Lemelech, it may have nothing to do with the fact that land would interfere with their avoda in the Beis HaMikdash, but rather it may have to do with fact, right, like Alvin said before, with the fact that they're already getting Trumos and Maestros. Since they're already getting Trumos and Maestros, therefore they are not going to get a portion in the land itself. Right, now, why didn't we make a referendum? Say, Kohanim, why don't you choose? Either you can have Trumos and Maestros, or you can have a portion, or you can have a portion in the land. So what that might suggest, and I think I tried to allude to this earlier, is that there's something about the nature of the laws of agriculture in Eretz Yisrael which necessitated, or which required, or which would work best if the Trumos and Maestros went to the Kohanim. And so therefore, they're doing it almost like as a favor to the Kedushas Haaretz, that they are becoming the recipients of the Trumos and Maestros. It's not a perfect suggestion, but it's the best that I can think of right now. And this is the Mishnah Melech's question. The Mishnah Melech wants to know, is the Kohanim's not getting land a function of their doing the Avoda, or is it a function of the fact that they receive Trumos and Maestros?
During the Beit HaMikdash doesn't seem to be a strong argument, because first of all, there was a part-time job. It was a very small portion of the year, and also the Beit HaMikdash didn't exist throughout most of the time. Only a very small portion. So that seems to weaken the argument that is a solid reason for it.
Right, so let me say it a little bit differently. Hashem Unachalaso. That to have God as your inheritance is already something which is supposed to be so consuming that a person can't be bound to the soil and at the same time have God as their inheritance. So it's more than just the Avodas HaMikdash. There's a mindset that the Kohanim are expected to be in the whole year, which will enable them to constantly be growing and constantly be appreciating their connection with God better. And then in the 2 weeks of the year, when they're actually in the Beis HaMikdash, they're going to be on the level. It's not like that that their mind is on the land and on the harvest and on the crops and on the spreadsheets and they have to tear themselves away and brush off their farming clothes and run to the Beis HaMikdash and get there at the last minute and then rush back afterwards. They're supposed to have a certain leisure, a certain freedom for contemplation, a certain relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is untroubled by all of the demands and the schedules and the deadlines of a farming life, and that may require that they be free the whole year and not be distracted by potentially having a farm to care for.
But isn't it their job was also to spread Torah studies and stuff like this?
Yeah, that could be very much so part of it. Yorumish patach al Yaakov v'sorach al Yisrael.
So how they're going to have even time to work the land or something like this? They're not going to have time to produce their stuff. In other words, you have a land, you have to work on it,
They won't have time for that.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. On the other hand, we know that Torah teachers could have come from all of the tribes and did in fact come from all of the tribes, and so it could be that those who chose this would choose this and those who chose that would choose that.
Yeah, but most of the teachers will come from Shevet Levi, because they have basically no other material things to work for. You understand? Just
Yeah, that was the initial expectation.
So they do get a nachala, the Levim. The pasuk seems to contradict itself.
Lo yinchalu nachala b'toch b'nei Yisrael. Tok b'nei Yisrael means they won't get the same nachla as the rest of the tribes of Israel.
They're
going to get a nachla, but not a nachla that's the same as the rest of the tribes of Israel.
They are getting a nachla.
Hashemu nachla, so the Meiser is their nachla. Right? Their nachla is something which is different than the nachla of the other tribes. Yes.
Yeah, that's what it is. Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
So I want to just make sure that we reach at least a stopping point. I don't think we're going to finish this particular section today, but at least I want to reach a stopping point by the time that we have to stop. So let's take a look at the Bizas Midyan, the Bizat Midyan that the Raivid made reference to. So what exactly does the Raivid think that he is proving from the Bizat Midyan? He's trying to prove that the Kohanim are not going to have a share even in Uganda if a Melech Yisrael were to conquer Uganda. I would have used a different country as an example, but...
It was a possibility. That's why he's
using it. Yeah, if we listen to
it... Right. Why did you say Rechavis Rishus?
Now then we white.
Yeah, good, good. So the Kesef Mishnah in Source 19 explains what the Raivin means when he makes reference to the Bizas Midyan. He says the Raivin means to point out that the Kohanim did not get a portion of the spoils of Midyan equal to that of the other tribes. So obviously, Midyan was not one of the countries that is part of Eretz Yisrael proper. If the Rambam was correct, that Kohanim are entitled to an equal share of the spoils in countries that are not Eretz Yisrael proper, and that Kohanim are entitled to an equal share of land in countries that are not Eretz Yisrael proper, so obviously, since they didn't get an equal share of the spoils by Midyan, countries that Hashem had not promised to the Jews have the same rules as countries that He did promise to them. So the problem with that is, if that's the case, then the Kohanim shouldn't have gotten anything from the Bizas Midyan. They should have gotten nothing, the same way that it says Lo Yihyeh, right? Chelek v'nachalah. They shouldn't get anything. Chelek Lo Yihyeh l'cha b'tocham. You're not going to get any spoils at all. And we know, again, Parshas HaShavua, that that was not the case. The Kohanim were entitled to 1 out of 500, 50. 1 out of 50 of all the spoils of Midyan, and that seems to be a difficulty for the Raivid. So the Raivid says, that's what he means, it was mitzvat yotzera kol yisparach. Whatever the Kohanim got from Midyan was a one-time law. It was a one-time thing that they got the 2%. But in the future, they won't get anything, even from countries that resemble Midyan and which are not part of Eretz Yisrael proper. Now, some people point out, and you can even see this at the end of the Kesef Mishnah, on page 6, all the way at the top, the second line. So I'm going to go back and read the middle of the Kesef Mishnah in a moment. The Kesef Mishnah says the Rambam can hold that Midyan was a paradigm for all unpromised lands. In other words, that just like the Kohanim got a share in the spoils of Midyan, so too they'll get a share in the spoils of all other lands that are not part of Eretz Yisrael proper. And just like they get a share in the spoils of those lands that are not Eretz Yisrael proper, they'll also get a share in the land of countries that are not Eretz Yisrael proper. So if you'll wonder, why is it that in Midyan they only got 2%, they should have gotten 1 out of 12 or 1 out of 13, an equal portion to the other tribes? Says, just as the Kohanim received part of the spoils of Midyan, they'll receive spoils from all similar lands. And if they didn't receive an equal share of the spoils, that's the one-time law. That's the Gzeiras HaKasov. That's the exception. Milchames Midyan, the Bizas Midyan, is unique both according to the Raivid and according to the Rambam. The Rambam says that they should have gotten 1/12, but that there was a Gzeiras HaKasov that they only got 1 out of 50. The Raivid says they should have gotten nothing, and there was a Gzeiras HaKasov that they got 1 out of 50. So the Milchames Midyan doesn't really seem to prove anything, because it is so idiosyncratic that it doesn't fit the model either that the Rambam sets up or that the Raivid sets up, to the point that it's very, very strange that the Raivid even quotes it as a proof. He seems to think it's a proof that they didn't get 1 out of 12, so obviously in other places they don't get anything. But that could just as easily, says a Kesef Mishnah, be a raya for Rambam that they got something. The fact that it was only 1 out of 50 was an exception, and in all future battles, they'll take 1 out of 12 and 1 out of 13. So Mirtz Hashem, we'll continue and we'll wrap this up. Tomorrow should take us about 10 or 15 minutes, the beginning of tomorrow, and then we'll move on to the next section.